It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station. We're broadcasting from up here on Signal Hill in Kodiak, Alaska, where it's overcast and 54 degrees. We are looking for rain, mainly after 4 p.m. today. Cloudy skies with a high near 55. East wind to 10. For tonight, rain, and it could be heavy at times. We're looking at between 1 to 2 inches of rain tonight. Low of about 52 overnight. East wind to 25 miles per hour. And those winds are expected to turn to the northeast on Wednesday and gust as high as 30 here in town, with gale warnings offshore around the island. Coming up on the Midday Report, Dylan has a story about the Nova Rupta ash that seems to intermittently plague us here in Kodiak. Dillingham School District has confirmed 4 positive cases of COVID-19. And the Ketchikan High School is closed. Those stories after this.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden is defending his decision to pull U.S. forces from Afghanistan, where the mission formally ended just before midnight local time. Moments ago, the president praised the U.S. military and Afghan allies for their work evacuating tens of thousands of people in recent weeks.
For weeks, they risked their lives to get American citizens, Afghans who helped us, citizens of our allies and partners and others on board planes and out of the country. And they did it facing a crush of enormous crowds seeking to leave the country.
Facing backlash for ending the mission now, Biden blamed his predecessor for putting the withdrawal into motion by making a deal with the Taliban. He says that agreement ensured a Taliban onslaught was coming. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards is imploring hurricane evacuees not to return home yet, given the widespread water and power outages. NPR's John Burnett has an update from New Orleans.
There's a heat advisory out today. They're expecting 100 degrees. New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell said she's mobilizing a fleet of buses as mobile cooling centers for residents who will get dangerously overheated. She also announced places for free food and cell phone charging, but that's only so helpful because the AT&T cell network is down in greater New Orleans.
NPR's John Burnett reporting. In California, crews are trying to stop the out-of-control Caldor Fire from burning into the town of South Lake Tahoe. We have the latest from NPR's Kirk Sigler.
The Caldor Fire is burning through dense stands of old-growth trees in the steep mountains around the Lake Tahoe Basin. This area has been in severe drought, made worse by climate change, and these forests are dangerously overgrown, paradoxically in part due to a history of suppressing wildfires. The evacuated town of South Lake Tahoe has historically been partly buffered by the namesake granite walls of the Sierra Nevada, but fire managers are reporting spot fires are being ignited by embers carrying in the wind sometimes miles in front of the main wall of flames. The high winds and heat are forecast to last through Wednesday night. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, South Lake Tahoe.
Google is delaying plans to bring employees back to the office until January. NPR's Shannon Bond reports it's the latest tech company to push out its timeline amid the surge of the Delta variant.
Google had already postponed plans for employees to return from September to mid-October. Now it says they won't be asked to come back before January 10th. And even then, the tech giant will let offices in different locations and countries make their own choices about when to reopen based on local conditions. Google is also requiring employees to be vaccinated before coming back in person. Apple, Amazon, and Facebook, which along with Google are NPR financial supporters, have also pushed back their office reopenings to January. Tech companies were some of the first employers to move to remote work when the pandemic began in early 2020. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
This is NPR.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
The Kodiak Emergency Operations Center has shared new information they have received about COVID-19 case information for the Kodiak Island Borough. 16 new cases have been reported for the borough. 2 of those cases are travel-related. 10 of them are classified as community spread, and 2 of them are considered close contact cases. 96 cases are currently classified as active locally in Kodiak. There are no active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. There have been 69 total local hospitalizations associated with COVID-19. The total case count for the borough is now 1,607. A mask mandate is in effect for public indoor activities. You're reminded to please stay home if you feel ill, even if your symptoms are mild, and contact a local medical clinic if you'd like to be tested for COVID-19. Vaccinations are available for COVID-19 in Kodiak. Contact your health care provider or pharmacist if you wish to be vaccinated. Well, while Kodiak relished a rare streak of bright, sunny, warm weather last weekend, the forecast also called for something a bit more ominous. Winds carrying volcanic ash from an eruption that occurred over 100 years ago. As KMXT's Dylan Simard tells us, it was literally a blast from the past.
It's been a big year for volcanoes in Alaska. They've managed to darken the skies and potentially pose a threat to health and safety. But this weekend, worries focused on volcanic ash that rained down 100 years ago. Ash left behind by Novarupta's 1912 eruption that buried parts of Alaska like a heavy snowfall. Some of that ash came back to haunt Kodiak last weekend. Pam Zatanek, who is based with the National Weather Service in Anchorage, says meteorologists call this resuspended ash.
What's been unique about this summer for the Alaska Peninsula and the Aleutians is we've had five active volcanoes that we've had to put products out for, and then we had two different volcanoes that we had to do resuspended ash products for. And Novarupta is, of course, the one that we tend to see the most resuspended ash from.
Zatanek says volcanoes are typically the realm of geologists, but when they affect the weather, that's when meteorologists like her step into the picture.
A lot of people don't realize that when it comes to volcanoes, meteorologists handle the volcanic ash and geologists handle all the seismic stuff. So anything dealing with volcanoes, it's a tag team event.
Ash advisories aren't issued too often, a few times a year at most. But when it's swept into the air, it can wreak havoc for those with respiratory problems. It's also dangerous when it's sucked into airplane engines. That's why it's important for meteorologists to track these volcanic particles, even if they're from a century ago.
That particular event, we could see it on satellite imagery, and we could also see it on webcams. So the FAA and also the Alaska Volcano Observatory, they have a series of webcams across the area, and we can click and see what's going on.
The ash advisory expired over the weekend without too much disruption to the enjoyment of unusually fair weather for Alaska's Emerald Isle. For KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Dylan Simard.
Yesterday, the Dillingham City School District confirmed four cases of COVID-19 across multiple grade levels, according to a news release from Superintendent Jason Johnson. Three of those cases were at Dillingham Elementary School, and one was at the middle high school. Close contacts that are unvaccinated will be barred from school for 10 days, according to the district's COVID-19 operations plan. If they have a negative test somewhere between days 8 and 10, those students can return on day 11. Vaccinated contacts may stay in school if they are symptom-free, but the district recommends testing 3 to 5 days after exposure. The district is currently has a mask policy in accordance with the city's emergency orders. Students may only remove masks during physical education courses or athletic activities. The school district will have a regular scheduled work session today at 6 p.m. in which they will discuss the public health plan. 3 days into the school year, Ketchikan High School is closed after reporting cases of COVID-19. The school sent students home mid-morning yesterday. It was the first full day of incapacity in-person instruction. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, high school students aren't expected to return until Wednesday at the earliest, and it's not the only school sending students home.
Classes started Thursday in Ketchikan with classrooms at half capacity for orientation. On Friday, the district reported its first COVID-19 cases of the year, one at Schoenbar Middle School and one at Ketchikan High School. Two more positives were reported among people associated with the high school on Sunday. Ketchikan High School Principal Jason House sent an email to parents at 10:47 a.m. Monday saying that more COVID-19 cases had been discovered and that students would be sent home immediately. Superintendent Melissa Johnson told KRBD Monday that Ketchikan High School has uncovered 6 new cases of COVID-19 since Friday, and a majority are believed to have been at school while infectious. She says the cases appear to be unrelated, which poses a greater risk to the school that makes it harder to isolate the infections. Johnson says the district decided to temporarily shutter the school to allow time for contact tracing in line with its plans. She said Monday that it's too early to know how many students will have to quarantine. The superintendent said some other schools had seen isolated cases that did not require full school closures under the district's plan. But Ketchikan Charter School's principal told KRBD Monday that the school's 6th, 7th, and 8th graders were sent home less than 2 hours after they arrived. Principal Kayla Livingston said the school was notified early Monday morning that someone associated with the school had tested positive over the weekend. Exactly when Ketchikan Charter School students can return to classes depends on whether they've been fully vaccinated, Livingston said in a letter posted on the school's website. Vaccinated students were told they could return Tuesday. Unvaccinated students were told they would need to be tested or quarantine. Ketchikan's school district requires masks and bans visitors during large COVID-19 outbreaks in the community. But unlike last year, students are learning in person, regardless of the number of confirmed cases in the community. The school district's plan doesn't allow for cuts to school capacity or large-scale remote learning during outbreaks, as it did last year. In recent weeks, Ketchikan has broken records for new COVID-19 cases, the number of active cases, hospitalizations, and deaths in a surge fueled by the Delta variant. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Juneau's power company is preparing to test its disaster plan should a 168-foot hydroelectric dam fail and flood a largely commercial district near the regional hospital. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, federal regulators say the century-old Salmon Creek Dam is safe, but released little information to prove it.
This coming Thursday, an area north of downtown Juneau will hear this.
We do the siren test every year, but this is the big one.
That's Debbie Driscoll, an Alaska Electric Light and Power Company executive in charge of community affairs. She says this year's test is part of a 5-year drill involving federal, state, and local authorities.
And this provides a complete test of the emergency action plan to determine if the plan is adequate to deal with an emergency arising from a failure of the dam.
The Salmon Creek Dam was finished in 1914 by the Alaska Gastineau Mining Company. At the time, it was the tallest in the world, and it's been in operation since, generating about 6% of the community's power and producing a third of its drinking water. Modeling of what would happen in the event of a major earthquake or other disaster shows a flood zone of mostly commercial buildings about 3 miles north of downtown.
And although Bartlett Regional Hospital itself is above the floodplain, the traffic to and from the hospital passes through the floodplain.
The hospital only has one road in and one road out. And that's led Juneau resident Randy Sutak to write to regulators seeking answers about the dam's condition.
My interest is I have a wife that works in the hospital area. And I started wondering one day, what would happen if? So I started writing emails and not getting answers.
That's him addressing Bartlett's Hospitals Board earlier this year.
If an earthquake takes out the dam, then an earthquake is also going to do a lot of damage to other buildings, we have to guess. And if we can't get those people to the hospital, then shame on us, because we have forewarning.
Juneau city officials say they rely on federal regulators to ensure the dam is maintained properly and doesn't put the community at risk. To be clear, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission also says the dam is safe. In response to Coast Alaska's questions, it released a letter its regional engineer wrote to Sutak dismissing his concerns. And Driscoll says the utility keeps the reservoir's water level at 35 feet below the dam's crest to reduce pressure on the concrete structure.
The dam, which is 47 feet thick at the base and 6 feet thick at the top, is in very good condition. It's a solid dam.
The concrete was last rehabilitated in 1967. Core samples were taken that year to inspect its condition. The next time core samples were drilled out was in 2011. Consultants recommended new samples be drilled every 10 years. So this year, Salmon Creek Dam would be due for more tests. But it's not clear if that will actually happen. Federal regulators didn't answer questions about this, but AEL&P released an excerpt from a report from a different consultant that said new concrete samples could wait until 2037. In the meantime, the private utility is updating its modeling for extreme rainfall and other weather events to keep its federal license current. Many of these details, in fact, most of the reports dealing with inspections, safety, and emergency planning, aren't freely available to the public. There's a federal rule that exempts critical energy infrastructure from disclosure. FERC says the rules date from the aftermath of the September 11th, 2001 attacks. But veteran journalists say the reluctance by regulators to share information goes back even further.
The argument that I've heard from dam security people is that, well, the terrorists are out there night and day hunting for the things in our infrastructure that would cause the most damage and harm.
Joseph A. Davis is an editor with a Society of Environmental Journalists. He's written about the federal rules that shield dams, pipelines, and other energy infrastructure from scrutiny as far back as the 1990s.
But it's also true that there have been virtually no terrorist attacks on dams in this country in the last century of dam building. And there have been many fatal dam failures from bad engineering, bad maintenance, and bad weather.
The most recent high-profile dam incident was near Oroville, California. Nobody was hurt, but nearly 190,000 people were evacuated when that dam spillway failed in an area north of Sacramento. Regulators insisted up to that point that the dam was sound, and the incident caused some soul-searching on how it had been allowed to happen. A congressional report recommended that the federal regulator do a better job of analyzing risks of its around 2,500 licensed dams.
You know, I think in general there has been a reluctance, a somewhat human natural reluctance to want to share information about unsatisfactory performance.
Martin McCann is director of the National Performance of Dams programs at Stanford University. He says utilities unfortunately aren't like airlines. When a plane crashes, there's public scrutiny and transparent reporting of lessons learned.
Slowly, the industry has begun to see the value of this, but it's been slow, and there is not an awful lot of, I'll call it, engineering detail that's available for enough of these incidents that we can fully leverage that information.
FERC says it's willing to open its files, but only if people sign non-disclosure agreements that carry legal consequences if the contents are shared. Davis, the environmental journalist, says for watchdogs and safety advocates, that's not workable.
It defeats the purpose of journalism, which is to inform the public.
Freedom of Information Act requests filed by Coast Alaska for the dam safety and inspection reports over the past several years remain pending. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
As a super contagious strain of the coronavirus sweeps across America and Alaska, there are no mask or vaccine requirements for state workers or Anchorage city workers. That's left a patchwork of protections and policies, and according to unions, some workers are frayed as the new strain threatens vaccinated Alaskans. Nat Hertz from Alaska Public Media has more.
Jake Metcalf, who heads Alaska's largest public employee union, has been hearing about a lot of workplace problems from his members over the past few days. At the Pioneer Home in Fairbanks, there's a COVID outbreak, and Metcalf says members are concerned about being asked to reuse their N95 masks. In Juneau, he's hearing complaints about inadequate mask wearing.
It's just a lot of people getting sick and a lot of people having to deal with the fear of getting sick. And so that's got a lot of our members really anxious.
The state of Alaska employs some 15,000 people, and Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy has declined to require them to wear masks at work. Among Metcalf's members, some are worried about catching the virus and bringing it home to their unvaccinated kids. Others are concerned about working with unmasked colleagues in confined spaces. The central problem, Metcalf says, is not enough communication about what the administration is doing to keep workers safe, particularly because of the contagiousness of the new variant.
People feel like it's an emergency. And, you know, until there's some sort of communication that we're going to have a safe workplace, I don't see that anxiety level decreasing at all.
Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy is still ruling out a mask mandate. And at a news conference last week, he suggested that state workers could protect themselves through voluntary masking and vaccination.
I would ask that people not be fearful, but have a conversation with their doc to really figure out the best way to approach this virus.
If state workers are still worried about getting a breakthrough case of the virus and bringing it home to unvaccinated family members, he says,
we've always allowed individual workers who have special circumstances, special cases, to have conversations with their supervisors to see if there could be changes to the way they work.
Metcalf, the union representative, says some employees have jobs they can't do from home. He also says it's not clear how much supervisors are making accommodations for workers who want them. In Anchorage, meanwhile, police union officials say members haven't made specific complaints about working conditions under new mayor Dave Bronson, but they note that a newly updated department policy allows unvaccinated officers to keep working even if they've been exposed to COVID. Deputy Chief Gerard Aslin says APD has to balance the interests of Anchorage residents and APD employees with the department's need to keep functioning.
And all of those things taken as a whole lead us to believe this is a responsible way to approach it for everybody involved.
Aslin says he understands if people are concerned about coming into contact with an officer who is exposed to the virus. But, he says, the department has been tracking how many of its exposed officers end up actually getting COVID, and it's a very small number. Allowing exposed, unvaccinated workers to stay on the job doesn't align with CDC guidelines, but Aslin says the risk is hugely reduced because anyone who chooses to keep working has to wear an N95 mask and social distance when possible.
When you take that limited window and then you couple it with the idea that they are also going to be wearing an N95 during that time, the risk of exposure to others is minuscule.
Vaccine requirements for Anchorage workers are not on the horizon anytime soon, as Anchorage Mayor Bronson says he won't push the shots. Governor Dunleavy's position is the same. The Anchorage Police Department isn't even tracking its vaccination rates, Aslin says, though union officials say they hear they're above 70%. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. The salmon market is hotter than ever. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
Alaska's salmon catch is on its way to 205 million fish, and by all reports, markets are set to buy all they can get. Here's how global supplier Tradex of British Columbia sums it up. Spokesperson Rochelle Ryerson.
Our recommendation is to buy everything and anything you need or will need for your inventories. Now, stocks will deplete and prices will continue to rise. If you require salmon, now is the time to buy and stock up or you will be left out.
Ryerson says any sockeye on the market quickly sold out.
As expected, the available sockeye that was on the market has already sold, and very quickly. Processors are even buying in the open market to ensure product for their programs, and with that, processors are taking POs in advance of fishing, and pricing is subject to catch.
The same holds true for farmed salmon. The COVID pandemic caused an explosion of salmon consumption, said James Griffin, director of the Chilean Salmon Marketing Council, to Undercurrent News. He said that Americans are more excited than ever to buy salmon, and even though food service has returned and prices are way up, sales remain at a torrid pace. Griffin added that the entire salmon market is unprecedented, describing it like an inflated balloon that's expanding exponentially across every supplier, whether it's wild or farmed. Chile is the top importer of farmed Atlantic salmon to the U.S., followed by Canada and Norway. The U.S. imported more than 450 million pounds of farmed salmon worth $2.1 billion from all sources in the first 6 months of this year, according to federal trade data. That's equivalent to 57% of the total volume and 62% of total value for all of 2020. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 45. This announcement was issued at 10 a.m. August 31st. There will be a 78-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, September 1st to 6 p.m. Saturday, September 4th in the Inner Karlik section of the Southwest Kodiak District. Closed waters will be as described in regulation. As previously announced, the following areas will open to commercial salmon fishing at noon Tuesday, August 31st, and remain open until further notice. The Sturgeon and Halibut Bay sections of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Inner Katoy Bay section of the Afognak District will close to commercial salmon fishing at 6 p.m. Tuesday, August 31st. Closed water adjustments. Until 6 p.m. Tuesday, August 31st, closed waters in the Inner Katoy Bay section will be the ADF&G markers at Little Katoy Creek, stream number 252323, and closed waters are increased to the ADF&G markers placed by hatchery staff near Big Katoy Creek, stream number 252324. The following areas remain open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. The Outer Karlik section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Northwest Kodiak District, the Southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District, the Cape Alitak, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District, and the Duck Bay, Iduit Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections of the Afognak District. The following areas will open to commercial salmon fishing for 78 hours from noon Thursday, September 2nd until 6 p.m. Sunday, September 5th. The Outer Iakulik section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Humpy Deadman section of the Alitak District, the Sikkalitik, Two-Headed, and Seven Rivers sections of the Eastside Kodiak District, and the Northeast Kodiak District. Until further notice, in that portion of the Northwest Kodiak and Southwest Kodiak districts, south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, Chinook salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Closed waters are shown on the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart and detailed in the Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations. Statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. Recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recordophone at 486-4559.
Welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the 31st and last day of August, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 7:09. It will set again at 9:08. That will give us 14 hours exactly of daylight. Well, not exactly, I guess. That's a loss of 4 minutes and 52 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 36, set in 1955 and 1973. And our record high was 75, set in 1930. Currently 54 degrees under a fog, mist, slash rain. It's east winds at 12 miles per hour at the airport right now. Visibility of 6 miles. For this afternoon, rain is likely, mainly after 4 p.m. Cloudy skies overnight with a high today near 55 and a low overnight near 52. East winds are expected to increase to 25 miles per hour tonight, along with heavy rain. We're looking at new precipitation tonight between 1 to 2 inches, and rain continuing tomorrow with northwest winds to 30 miles per hour, and the rain's continuing Wednesday night as well, with rain also possibly very heavy for Wednesday night. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up at 2:28 this afternoon. That'll be a 4.1-foot tide here on the east side. That'll be followed by a high tide at 9:06 this evening of 7.3 feet, a low tide at 4:53 a.m. of 1.9 feet, and a high tide at 11:56, just about 12 o'clock straight up, 5.3 feet. Over on the west side, and this is Larsen Bay, you have a low tide coming up at 3:15 p.m., that'll be a 6.3-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 9:33 this evening of 10.9 feet, a low tide at 5:14 a.m. of 2.7 feet, and a high tide at 11:44 a.m. of 8.6 feet on the west side. We do have gale warnings on both sides of the island, from Marmot Island to Sitkanak.
For tonight, northeast winds to 35 knots, seas to 11 feet. For tomorrow, northeast 35, becoming east 20. Tomorrow afternoon, seas at 10 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning tonight and Wednesday. For tonight, northeast wind to 35 knots and seas to 12 feet in the Shelikof. For tomorrow, northeast 40, seas to 16 feet in the Shelikof. And for Wednesday night in the Shelikof, northeast 35, seas to 12 feet.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.